Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Former Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Jeffrey Amestoy has just written a new book chronicling the life of Richard Henry Dana Jr. It's called Slavish Shore. As a young man in the 19th century, Dana's account of his time at sea led to his writing the classic book 2 years before the mast. Then Dana got a law degree and was involved in some of the most important legal cases of the century. He strongly opposed the Fugitive Slave Act in the court system. He defended the war powers of President Abraham Lincoln, and he played a key role in efforts to prosecute Confederate President Jefferson Davis in the years following the Civil War. Today in the program, we look at the life of Richard Henry Dana Jr. and how his actions angered many of the people in the upper society of Boston. Jeff Amestoy, welcome to the program. Great to have you back.
Thanks, Bob. Very nice to be here.
Now, you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Have you read Dana's book, 2 years Before the Mast? What kind of impact do you think it had when it was released in 1840? As I mentioned, Dana was a fierce opponent of the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s, and he also received a fair amount of criticism for his beliefs from people in the Boston area. What does this tell us about the political views of Boston's high society during that time period? He defended the authority of President Lincoln to put a blockade of southern ports in place during the Civil War. The Supreme Court upheld this practice by a 5-4 vote. What would have happened to the Northern war effort if this case had gone the other way? Your thoughts, questions, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Jeff, before we discuss the details of this book, which is a wonderful read, I had a great time reading this book. Tell us why you decided to write the book. When does the life experience of Richard Henry Dana Jr. become something that you take an enormous interest in?
Well, that's a good question. It's one I've asked myself. It seemed to appear out of nowhere, but I think probably the reason that I first got interested was two years before the mast, and as you indicated, published in 1840, 175th anniversary of the book was this September. It's hard to think of very many nonfiction books that have been in print for 175 years. It's truly a classic, and it's a tremendous sort of coming of age story by someone whom you cannot help but admire when you read the book. He wrote it when he got back. It was published when he was 25 years old. He had gone as a Harvard dropout. He was from the upper echelons of Boston society, and he met people that his family never would have talked to, much less met. And that changed his view of humanity, I think. And it just occurred to me that someone who wrote that kind of book couldn't possibly have ended up to be the stereotypical Brahmin lawyer defending the interest of the establishment. And so I got interested in his legal career after he came back, and it turned out that he was, though he never left the establishment, he was always in the face of the establishment, and he was confronted American hypocrisy at a time when it needed to be confronted. So I was off to the races, and most of his papers are in the Boston area in the Massachusetts Historical Society and in Cambridge at the Longfellow House, and so I spent a fair amount of time in the archives and tried to tell his story in a way that carries the reader along because like all of us, you don't know how the story is going to end as you're living it.
So how did you prepare to write it? You did a lot of firsthand research?
I did. I mean, most of his the Dana family is one of the oldest families in the United States. So so well known, in fact, that George Washington actually used Adams Dana as a password during the Revolutionary War. The Danas and the Adamses were families who have equally, if not equally distinguished history, equally long histories. Dana's grandfather was Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, had taken John Quincy Adams to to Russia as a special envoy. And the Danists never threw anything away, I don't think. So there's thousands and thousands of papers at the Massachusetts Historical Society and at the Longfellow House and to a lesser extent at Harvard. So I spent, you know, a fair amount of time looking at those papers. Dana also left a journal. He was a fantastic writer, as anyone who's read 2 years before the Mass knows. And his journal, which he began when he was 26 and wrote until he was about in his late 40s, is really a day-to-day account of his life. And I tried to incorporate that into my book because it gives a sense of events as they unfolded. And again, of course, he didn't know how the story was going to turn out.
So as you did all this research for this book, what surprised you the most?
I think what surprised me the most is the extent to which Boston, which I think at least in popular history and history as I remembered it from high school and college, one always thinks of Boston before the Civil War as sort of the epitome of Northern abolitionist fever and strongly against slavery. It was true to some extent, but not anywhere near to the extent that one thinks it might be true. Certainly there were abolitionists. There were those against the strongly opposed to slavery. The Boston establishment, by which I mean really the names you would still recognize in Boston history, I think, were almost pro-slavery between the 1850s up until the Civil War. And the reason for that was because their economic interests began to coincide with the Southern slaveholders, the folks that ran the great the mills that in Lawrence and in Boston and in the mill towns we still see, they needed the slave-produced cotton. And so when their economic interest, Boston's economic interest, began to align with the slaveholders, they became very much a slaveholding community. And the so-called best people, I think, really supported the fugitive slave law. And Dana, who was a member of that society, ended up confronting them directly over that in the period between about 1851 and right up to until the Civil War. And I think that's just part of a history that at least was not known to me, and I expect not known to very many other people.
Today on the program, our guest is former Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Jeffrey Amestoy, the author of a new book, Slavish Shore, The Odyssey of Richard Henry Dana, Jr. 1-800-639-2211 if you've got a question or a comment. Let's turn to Susan in Moortown. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks so much. Hi, Jeff. It's Susan, Linda Purdy's partner.
Hi, Susan.
And I just want to say I read this book this summer, and it was such a fantastic read. Like, I enjoyed it so, so much. And I loved the descriptions of his time as a sailor. And then, like you were saying, Jeff, wow, the fact that Boston was, you know, not this, not only a bastion of anti-slavery was really interesting to me. So I just want to recommend it for people as Christmas gift for people because it's really a fantastic book.
Thanks very much, Susan. That's wonderful to hear, and I'm very glad you enjoyed it. One of the interesting I don't know how interesting to your listeners, but interesting to me as I went through this process. But the book is published by Harvard University Press, who has a tremendous, of course, scholarly reputation, and their authors are some of the finest scholars in the country and in the world, really. This book was a little bit different for them in the sense that I brought to it certainly some experience as a lawyer and as a judge, but not any experience as a professional historian. And it was interesting as I went through the process, which is long and involved. I got some pushback because they said the book was too accessible and too much like a popular history. I actually thought that was sort of a compliment. I think So I do think – I think the listeners who might believe, because it's a Harvard University Press book, that it is really an academic book, I don't think they'll find that to be the case. And I'm delighted you found the narrative interesting.
Let's talk to Brendan, who is calling from Lake Placid, New York. Hey, Brendan, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hello. I manage the John Brown Historic Site here in Lake Placid. That's the home and gravesite of John Brown, the abolitionist, the anti-slavery crusader. And Dana actually met him. I don't know if the author would want to relate that story. He was lost in the woods and came upon Brown's cabin here in Lake Placid.
That's exactly right. And Dana had an interesting pattern in his life. First evidence, I think, when he dropped out and went to sea, and it really seemed to occur every August. He would disappear from Boston and from the practice of law and go to sea or hike. And on one of these occasions, in the late 1840s, he was in the Adirondacks and was lost. And he came across a cabin. And he writes this in his journal, and he's taken in by this farmer who has a large bevy of children and African-American workers. And Dana's just astounded at – first of all, he's astounded at Brown's level of knowledge. And then Dana, being from a different culture, of course, really is flabbergasted that they all sit down at the same table – blacks and whites, and Brown addresses everyone, black or white, as Mr. or Miss. And so Dana's quite taken by this, but of course has no idea that there's anything particularly noteworthy other than the fact that he found shelter when he needed it. Years later, Dana learns, of course, that the John Brown that he met was the John Brown of Harper's Ferry. And actually, in early 1870s, Dana wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly that talked about that. And I think he says something like, "Who could have believed that farmer in upstate New York was someone who was going to shake the slaveholding republic of the United States to its core?" So, quite a dramatic story. Dana's always seemed to, I think, because he had this sort of piece of him that was an adventurous spirit. Always seemed to end up in places where he found adventure, if adventure found him.
You know, you mentioned his writing 2 years before the mast after his experience at sea. He comes back. He's definitely affected by the flogging and the brutality that he sees at sea, and what the sort of the rule of the captains of the sea. When he writes that book and it becomes a best-selling book, is it an eye-opener for people at the time and gives them a very sort of displaces what might have been a very romantic view that they had of the sea?
I think that's correct. I mean, for one, the first reason the book is powerful, of course, because it's so well written. Secondly, though, you know, Boston was was one of the ship merchant capitals of the world. And the extent to which it began to become apparent to people that part of the fortunes of Boston were literally built upon the backs of those who were flogged to go to the far corners of the earth in search of cargo and economic benefit for the ship owners, it was part of a larger movement at that time that I think brought that in terms of the American culture, they began to look at punishment, not only corporal punishment in schools, but the flogging of sailors, the beating of prisoners in prisons, all began to be, I think, paid more attention to. And certainly Dana's 2 years before the mast had a piece of that, as did Melville's White Jacket, which actually replicates almost exactly a couple of the passages in Dana's book. Melville was a good friend of Dana's, and in fact, Melville thought Dana's 2 years before the mast was unmatchable. And both of those books, I think, certainly contributed to a an effort, and in fact, some legislation in Congress that tried to protect sailors.
Today in the program, our guest is former Vermont Supreme Court Justice Jeffrey Amestoy. We're discussing his new book, Slave Ashore, The Odyssey of Richard Henry Dana Jr. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Dana's work during the Civil War. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, former Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Jeffrey Amestoy, author of the new book, Slave Ashore, The Odyssey of Richard Henry Dana Jr. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. We did get this email from Cecilia in Windsor, Vermont, who said, as a teenager, I read Dana's novel and found it the most moving account of seafaring I would ever read. I'm sorry it did not ever become a required classic, as it so deepened one's experience and sense of life. God knows it was well written enough. And we also got, I thought this was great, got an email from Tad Dana, who lives in Northfield, Vermont, who says of your book, it was a wonderful read, learned a great deal about my great-great-grandfather, the connection to H.W. Longfellow, also a great-great-grandfather, makes the book even more interesting, and he wants to thank you for all your research and interest in this subject. Let's go to the Civil War and the War Powers Act and his involvement in the whole blockade of the South. It's a very interesting legal case. What hinges on the outcome of this case?
The so-called prize cases, which were argued before the United States Supreme Court in the beginning of 1863, right in the middle of the war, really went to the question of whether Lincoln had the authority under the War Powers to continue the war. As I researched that, I began to think again about the uniqueness of the American experience. There's probably no country in the world that would ever have a system in which the question could arise quite the way that arose. It arose out of a commercial dispute, basically. Those owners of ships that had been seized by the Union for running the blockade sued to get their ships back and the value of their cargo back. As often happens in a war, I think one forgets that life goes on, the commercial interest goes on, people want to make money. The ship owners were represented by the best lawyers some of the best lawyers in the country. All the famous New York lawyers represented the ship owners, and their argument before the United States Supreme Court was, these ships were seized without constitutional authority because there was no war declared there's no war going on. This is an insurrection. Blockades can only happen if there's a war between sovereign states. The Confederacy is not a sovereign state. So we wish the court to rule that this blockade is illegal. This raised directly the question of whether Lincoln had the constitutional authority to carry on the war. And it's rather astounding that at a point in time where a million men under arms in the Confederate and Union armies, where we'd had the Antietam, the bloodiest battle in the history of the war to that point, with over 20,000 casualties, the Supreme Court of the United States was actually considering the legal question, is this in point of law a war? And Dana really had to talk his way into the case. He was a U.S. attorney in Massachusetts at the time. He'd had one of the cases below. There were cases that were consolidated dealing with five ships. And because of his experience as a sailor, he probably had greater – and because he was a brilliant lawyer, he had greater knowledge of prize law and interest in it than any lawyer in the country. And it was very fortunate for the United States that the Attorney General finally allowed Dana to participate in the case because, as you indicated in your opening remarks, it was a 5-4 decision. Had it gone the other way, Lincoln's authority to issue the Emancipation Proclamation to continue to institute the draft, all would have been very doubtful.
That's an amazing case that probably a lot of people are not familiar with, a 5-4 decision that really could have had an enormous outcome on the whole Civil War.
Yeah, many people, at least historians much who spent much more time on the issue than I have, felt that had that case gone the other way, there would have been – because the United States, in the first instance, would have been liable for tremendous amount of damages, not only for those ships that were seized in the instant case, but all ships that had been seized prior to the case, and that would have prompted some kind of a settlement with the South. My own view is probably Lincoln would have carried on the war sort of unconstitutionally, if you will. But in any event, it was an extraordinarily important case, and it was seen as such at the time.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Bob in Morrisville. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Well, Your Honor, I just wanted to comment and congratulate you for bringing 2 years before the mass to the consciousness, back to the consciousness of everybody. It's a really good book, and I actually wrote a book and cited it in my preface with the opening. But it's a really good one thing people forget. It's a really good travel story, and his descriptions of the American Southwest desert, where San Diego is now, are just starkly different from the way it is now. Just a very good travel story and entertaining. And also it shows how someone from a privileged class, you know, Richard Henry Dana, his father was an attorney, went and worked in the laboring class of the merchant seamen at the time and informed himself about, you know, the culture of America's laboring class. And I think that's an important, it's a very noble thing to do, and it's an important example, especially in a time now when America is becoming Europeanized and our class structure is becoming more rigid, and people avoid the kind of workers' experience that Dana had. Thank you.
Bob, thanks for your phone call. Let's talk to Brandon in Warren. Hey, Brandon, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was listening to the radio, and I heard you talking about this book that I read years ago, and I was remembering it, and one thing came to mind that I remember. He made a prediction. I think it was he was in San Francisco, and he was in the Bay, and he was saying, this will be a magnificent port one day for trade. I thought that was just very insightful when I read it. It stuck with me. Years later now, I still remember that from the book. It might have been L.A. I might be mistaken about San Francisco. But anyway, thank you for talking about the book today. I'm learning a lot.
Great, Brandon. I think Brandon's right.
Yeah, Brandon's exactly right. It was San Francisco, and Dana writes of San Francisco. If California ever becomes a part of the United States, this bay will be and San Francisco will be a central part of it. And what's interesting is when he first arrives in San Francisco as a sailor on the Alert, the ship Alert that sails into San Francisco Bay in 1835, there's literally only one there's a shack there, and there's the ruins of the Presidio and the mission. Dana returns 24 years later. He has in his – when he finally gets the copyright to 2 years before the mast, he adds a chapter called 24 Years Later, and it's about going back to California in 1859. When he goes back to California in 1859, it's a city. I mean, it would be recognizable today. Dana can literally almost not believe it. And I wanted to – so, Brandon, you're exactly right, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I think – and to go back to the first – the previous caller's comments as well, 2 years before the mass, sometimes I go back and I look at Slavish Shore, and I'm saying, well, you know, this writing is pretty good. And then I realize, you're just quoting Dana here. And one of the one of the for those who haven't read 2 years before the Mass, one I think one of the what I tried to do in Slave Ashore, because his experience for exactly the reasons that your caller mentioned is so significant in terms of his learning about what real life is like. I really had to give readers some picture of 2 years before the Mass, and I tried to do that in two chapters that really excerpt a fair amount of a shortened version, if you will, of 2 years before the Mass. But I think it shaped his character, which in turn shaped the history of America. So I think it was extraordinarily important. And as to the travelogue aspect of it, exactly right. You can read it just for the enjoyment, 2 years before the Mass, just for the enjoyment of it. There's a passage when they, after almost 5 months at sea, they come into this bay, and it's January, and Dana, January of 1835, and Dana says, "Well, come on out on deck to see what kind of country we got ourselves into." First thing we notice is it's really warm. We had our summer clothes on. They were in San Diego or Santa Barbara, the bay. So, you know, they were struck by what millions who came after them were struck by as well, the weather of California. But it's quite fascinating, I think, to read about it in that context.
Today in the program, our guest is former Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Jeffrey Amesdoy, talking about his new book, Slave Ashore, The Odyssey of Richard Henry Dana Jr. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Brendan, who is calling from Brunswick, Vermont. Hey, Brendan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Jeffrey, we were colleagues back in the years in Montpelier at state government.
Terrific. Yes, good
I
to hear from
tell you.
I
want to tell you, especially for your earlier one who emailed in, the family member, when I was in Episcopal Seminary in Cambridge, the dean lived in a house off Phillips Place, Brattle Street, and would bring us into the dining room downstairs and show us in the window, the glass window looked out, the initials RHD, which had been scratched in, allegedly, family legend, by his mother's diamond ring as a precocious lad before he went to sea, and those initials are still there as far as I know. Did you run across that story?
I didn't run across that story, but it's a very timely one because Dana's house, of which there's a picture of it in the book, the house that he and his family lived in, is in Cambridge. It's still there. It is part now of Lesley University and still the Episcopal Divinity School.
That's correct. Lesley combined with our seminary. So at that time, it was the dean's house of the Episcopal Theological School. So that's my tie.
Right.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to reading it, Jeff.
Thank you. As luck would have it, I actually just heard from – so I know the house. I've been very interested in getting into the house, but I hadn't made the contact yet, and someone just wrote me actually this morning to say, good news, we're going to get you into the Dana House next Friday. So I got the opportunity to see that. Dana writes a wonderful description of the house, I think, and it'll be very interesting to see that through his eyes, and I'll ask about the initials as well. So thanks for the call.
Let's turn to Brian, who's calling from Montreal. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm Canada side, you know, and when I hear about American history pre-Civil War, it's a mystery to me because we don't get much of that. American history didn't affect Canada that much until the war between the states. But when you talk about 1835, when 2 years before the Mass came out, that was exactly when the Oregon Trail was populating the Northwest, when the rivalries between American outposts and the British Empire, which controlled that coast, were becoming an international issue. And in fact, the whole question of where the border lies between our Pacific outposts and America's Pacific outposts is a really big issue. You know, 54-40 or fight became a presidential issue. does he talk about that question of where American interests lie, where America's rights lie, what are the possibilities for the new growing America at that time when he was right there on the coast?
I think not so much in those terms, but certainly first in the terms of he's a 19-year-old between the ages of 19 and 21, so he speaks up. He writes of the coast in terms of its I think some very astute descriptions and insights into the, both the character of the Yankees who are on the coast. And there are a few of them who we can't stand, and then the Spanish, who Dana has a great deal of respect for, but certainly as you get as Dana becomes a contemporary, if you will, of the events you've described, then he is very much, I think, involved in the extent to which America begins to expand, and particularly not so much in the 54-40 fight, the James Polk piece of it, but sort of the even less attractive side of American expansion, the Mexican War, which really was a war prompted by the United States that then had extraordinary repercussions for the United States because it then opened up the whole question of to what extent should slavery be extended. Ralph Waldo Emerson famously said, "The Mexican War will poison us," and he wasn't very far off.
So, as you look at the life of Richard Henry Dana Jr. and all the issues that he was involved in, do you see some relevancy to life in the United States today?
I do. I mean, I think for one, particularly when you talk about this period before the Civil War and Dana's effort to stand up to those who wanted to enforce the fugitive slave law, particularly, I think Americans tell ourselves a better history than we deserve. And one part of the history we tell ourselves is that the North and the attitude towards African Americans was a sort of a Southern kind of issue, and in the North we were all on the right side. That was not true of the most important establishment in America. Brahmin Boston in Boston at the time, 1850, 1860, was economically, socially, and politically the most powerful part of the United States of America. Daniel Webster was the most powerful single politician in the country. He was Secretary of State and powerful senator. His support for the fugitive slave law and then his efforts as in directing prosecutors and law enforcement to seize black residents of Boston and send them into slavery, I think that still echoes today. I mean, when you start to think about the experience of African Americans, the difficulties in terms of Black Lives Matter is not something that arose out of urban America in the 1970s. It arose out of the history of the United States, and I think the more we can know about that, perhaps the better we are able to deal with it. And certainly, I think Dana's personal character and actions are instructive in terms of demonstrating the hypocrisy of a class of which he was a part.
We're almost out of time, but any other books on the horizon?
No, this is, like everything else, it looked easy from the outside. But it was a long haul, but a very rewarding one, and I hope rewarding to those who read it as well.
We've been talking today to former Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Jeffrey Amestoy about his new book, Slave Ashore, The Odyssey of Richard Henry Dana Jr. It's a fascinating book that takes a close look at this country's legal and political world in the mid-19th century. Jeff, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Transportation Secretary Chris Cole about the new 5-year federal transportation bill and what it means for the state of Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Congress is set to pass a new long-term transportation bill. It's the first long-term bill in over a decade. In the last 10 years, Congress has adopted 37 short-term fixes, largely because there's been strong disagreement over how to fund this legislation. The new bill allocates $305 billion over the next 5 years. Under this proposal, Vermont will receive roughly $1.1 billion over the 5 years, and this represents about a 10% increase in spending. So what does this plan mean for the state of Vermont? With us now to discuss this question is Transportation Secretary Chris Cole. Thanks for coming in and being part of the program.
Thanks, Bob.
So before we discuss the details of this plan, I'm wondering, have the short-term fixes over the past 10 years made it hard for your agency to do much long-term planning?
It does make it challenging with some of the larger projects that span several construction seasons that are in the tens of millions of dollars. You really want to have some certainty when you sign that contract with the contractor that the money is going to continue to flow during the period of performance. And when you have these short-term month-to-month extensions, it doesn't give you any sort of concrete stability in terms of managing projects. So we're really pleased that Congress was able to pass a long-term bill. The two most important elements of this bill, one, it's a five-year bill, which gives us that planning that we can do. And two, Vermont did not lose any money. As you mentioned, we saw an increase in funding, which is going to be beneficial.
So there are a number of programs, transportation programs, that will be funded under this bill. Let's take a look at Vermont roads. How does this bill affect Vermont's highways?
So we're going to see about a $96 million increase over the five-year life of the bill. Just in fiscal year 16 alone, we're going to receive an additional $10 million, and then approximately $5 million increases on top of that for the next successive 5 years. We've been doing a great job in terms of turning around the performance of the roads. We've had ERA funding come in. IRENE money came in. We are at about 13% of our roads in what I would call very poor condition. That's from a high in 2009 of 34%. This funding is going to allow us to push forward in terms of improving that performance and making our customers, visitors to Vermont and Vermonters, satisfied with our road condition.
So would the primary goal be to keep the existing roads in good shape as opposed to building new expensive roads?
No, we've actually got a blended program. So we've been averaging $100 million a year on our paving program to get at the backlog of poor roads. But at the same time, we're pushing roadway projects that have been in the pipeline for years. We have a bit of a spike in projects coming together. And this is going to help us through that bubble of projects. So this couldn't have come at a better time for Vermont and is going to allow us to both do some roadway projects like the Champlain Parkway, Route 7 projects that the public has been waiting for a long time.
How will this new legislation address Vermont bridges that have been identified as being structurally deficient?
Well, the funding will also go for the bridges, but in that area as well, last year we had met and exceeded all of our performance targets for FY14. For FY15, the preliminary reports are coming in, but we are have exceeded all of our targets and improved on our performance over last year. So I can sit here and thank our contracting community and VTrans staff for the extraordinary good work that they've done over the last 4 to 5 years, because we're below 7% structurally deficient bridges in Vermont. And 4 years ago, it was double that. So we've done extraordinarily good work. We've had an accelerated bridge program, which has reduced the amount of time we can take a bridge from concept to completion and shaved at least 2 years off it. Where we were at 6 to 8 years before on a bridge, we're now down to 4 years. So this has been an extraordinary achievement to think outside the box and use innovative techniques. I don't know if you remember, but we put in a bridge over two successive weekends on I-91 in the town of Hartford with a lateral slide. So we're innovating. We're using the taxpayer dollars more efficient, and I can't wait to see what we can do with this extra funding.
How did that project work? It seemed like an engineering marvel.
We're not the first state to do this. In fact, we're coming to the game a little bit later than others. We're following Massachusetts, which is a leader in accelerated bridge program and this slide technology. But basically, you're moving the bridge along a metal I-beam an inch at a time with hydraulic jacks and just sliding it into place. You actually build it adjacent to the bridge you're going to dismantle. Then you dismantle it overnight and begin sliding the other bridge. So we started the project at after rush hour on Friday and finished it before rush hour Monday morning.
This new bill also calls for an increase in funding for public transit, and it includes money for public transit capital programs. How important is this provision for Vermont?
This is one of the most critical provisions for Vermont. We had relied upon the congressional delegation to get the state of Vermont earmarks, and those earmarks would come to V-Trans, and then we would apportion them out to transit districts based upon their need. With Congress not doing any more earmarking of funds, and there being no capital funds within the FTA program, we were forced to begin to use federal highway money and transfer it over to the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration account, to purchase these buses. This new program is going to allow us to keep our federal highway money going towards roads and bridges and using some of this FTA money. So not only are we getting a bump of $500,000 in our formula money to purchase buses, we're also going to be able to compete in a discretionary pool in the New England region for bus money. So this is very good news for Vermont.
You know, some people might look at Vermont and say it's a very rural state and therefore a public transit system will never be effective. What would you say to those folks?
Well, having managed the public transit system for 10 years, I would not agree with that statement at all. We started commuter bus services in the state of Vermont in 2002, and Vermonters have overwhelmingly responded that if offered the opportunity to ride a commuter bus, they will take it. The ridership trends in public transportation increase every year, and we have exceeded national ridership trends as a state for a while. So I kind of discount that popular wisdom. Vermonters, as most New Englanders, are frugal, and if you can provide them with a cheaper way to get to work, they're going to take it in most instances.
This new bill also includes additional money for rail programs. How will that play out in Vermont?
Well, this is a brand new program to have a rail title in the Surface Transportation Bill, and this is going to provide Vermont with some opportunities. So there's a consolidated rail program, which is new, which are freight and passenger projects, and there's a 25% rural set-aside. So we're happy to see the Congress is acknowledging that there needs to be a set-aside for rural states to adequately compete. And then there's funding for expanding a restoration of new services. And as our state is poised to expand the Ethan Allen service north to Burlington in the next 4 years, and as we're working to expand the Vermonter service to Montreal, the ability to use federal funds to pay for the operating costs at some level for 3 years while those services mature is going to be extraordinarily helpful to our state. This is a great thing to have some funding coming in for rail.
Do you think if we had this conversation 4 years from now, we would see passenger service from Montreal to Burlington to Rutland to Albany to New York City?
I would like to say yes. We need some congressional action for the Vermonter service. Former Secretary Searles is working hard with our own congressional delegation, with the Canadian federal government, the U.S. federal government, Customs and Border Protection agencies, Amtrak, all the players. And I think based on his optimism that I will say yes, we will see the Vermonter service extended to Montreal in 4 years. And on the Burlington service, absolutely. There's no impediment to that. We've gotten the Western Corridor Rail Grant this summer with a lot of hard work by our congressional delegation. So that one is more certain.
Chris, it is the beginning of December. Earlier this week, we had a clear demonstration of how treacherous icy roads can be. Really, all types of roads, the interstate, state roads, town roads. What's your advice for drivers as they encounter these conditions and as these winter months come on?
Typically what we see is when the winter weather begins hitting the roadways, there's a delay in terms of drivers adjusting their behavior. We see a lot of cars off the road with the first couple of storms. And because the weather is a bit spotty now, you know, going above and below the freezing line, there's more opportunities for freezing rain, as we saw the other day. And really, drivers need to create that extra space between them and the car in front. If somebody's going to brake unexpectedly, you want to have enough time to slow down. So you need to back off the car in front of you a little bit. You need to adjust your speed a little bit. And please give our workforce plenty of room when you see the snowplow out there operating. They're operating at a reduced speed. When you see those flashing lights ahead of you, understand that that vehicle is probably moving 35 to 40 miles per hour, which is a big adjustment in speed you're going to have to make if you're on the interstate.
Transportation Secretary Chris Cole, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That is our program for today. Monday on Vermont Edition, lace up the skates. We're talking hockey. Vermont is rabid for its winter sports, and hockey is high on that list. Send your questions or comments about hockey to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.